Hey folks, welcome to another episode of 10 Laws with East Forest, the podcast. This week, I'm really excited to bring to you a conversation I had a little bit ago with somebody named KMO. It's not a rapper name. It's just like, to be honest, I don't know where that name came from, but it's a name and a moniker that he has gone by, KMO, for quite some time. And he's had a podcast that's called the C Realm Podcast. That's C Realm Podcast, where the C stands for consciousness. And KMO goes way back to the early days of podcasting, sort of like along with Lorenzo from the Psychedelic Salon, who I also had on the show. And he's someone that I listened to early on, and someone that had a lot of influence, brought a lot of interesting ideas into my life. And, you know, through podcasting, like through listening to his podcast, I felt like I got to know the guy. And he introduced me to a lot of ideas. He talked about psychedelics a little bit on his show, but he talked a lot about peak oil, environmental stuff, energy, just general philosophical ideas. And I learned a lot. So I was really excited to reach out to KMO and get a chance to catch up with him. He's someone that I've seen over the years in person. I think we ran into each other at a conference in New York City. I can't remember what it was for. It might have been like a Singularity conference or Peak Oil or something like that. But it was really great to talk to him. So happy to have him on board this week. I also just got back from New York City, which was good to be there. You know, I used to live there for just about 9 years. So it was quite a trip. It's always a trip to go back. I don't know if any of you have lived in New York. It's one of those things that when you're there, it feels like the most important place in the world. And then when you leave, you think to yourself, how did I ever live there? How did I manage such a thing? And so when I go back, I don't feel like I quite have my New York energetic legs. But I got to go there with Marissa this time, and it was fun to show someone the town, and I got to play a show there, which was awesome. Thank you to everyone who came out to the Rockwood Music Hall show. It was cool. It was cool to see so many supportive faces, for us to make a little audio room right there in downtown and Lower East Side of Manhattan, to have them bring the Steinway piano in on a crane. I thought that was pretty unusual. It was like only in New York can they only fit a piano on stage like that if they use a crane, and they actually have one. But I really did appreciate having the opportunity to play and play in this new style that I've been exploring of really just heart-centered concerts. And even if it was, albeit a relatively short concert, 45 minutes, I felt like everyone there had an unbelievable level of attention and courtesy with their attention. Because as I've said many times, your attention is your currency. And you guys gave me a lot of riches that night. And it really allowed me to feel supported and feel welcomed. And that's just such a beautiful space to give and receive. I felt like you were giving me so much, and I was giving as much as I could back through the live music. So thank you again to everyone who came out to the show in New York, especially, I forget your name, but the girl from MIT who came all the way from Boston just to see that show. I thought that was pretty cool. So thank you so much. I've been on the road for over a month. It's funny, like I left town for a week thinking, I went to Esalen for a week thinking I'd be right home. And because of various events and circumstances and Marissa also inviting me to something else. Anyway, I've been on the road. I'm going to be on the road for 2 months. And I can't think of a time that I was gone that long. But it's sort of an amazing feeling when you think you're only going to be gone for a little bit, like a week, and you end up leaving your home base for that long. It's slightly scary, but also quite liberating. And if anyone has the opportunity and the flexibility in their life, which obviously is a blessing, I recommend it. It's sort of like walking this interesting tightrope line of getting out of your comfort zone and working with what you have. So I've been rocking the same clothes for a bit, working from the laptop and buying things on Amazon that I needed along the way. But I will be in Portland, Oregon this weekend because I'm kicking off a 2-week run with the AWOL Dance Company. It's a remount of a show that we did a few years ago that's pretty cool. It's in the forest outdoors. It's aerial dancing. They rig it in the trees. It's performed in the round, and I am performing the music live with them there. So check it out. There's probably a few tickets left for that with the AWOL Dance Company. You can always just go to eastforest.org/tour, and you can check out info and tickets on that. But we have just a couple spots left for the East Forest Retreat in the fall. And it's also looking like there might be some other opportunities and retreats coming up in 2019 I'm excited about at Esalen and maybe a few other places. So stay tuned for that. Otherwise, just been working on some interesting projects that I'm still really looking forward to announcing really, really soon. And that's about it. So let's just dive into this, okay? This is KMO. Dig it. KMO, thank you so much. Good to see you again.
Likewise.
It's been a bit.
Yeah, not that long, like maybe 2-3 years.
Yeah, I think I saw you. You were at a conference in New York. Actually, I think it was longer ago than you think. It was, what was that at Cooper Union? It was.
It's the Horizons Conference.
No, it wasn't Horizons, wasn't it? Because Horizons, I've been to, that's usually up at Judson Memorial Church in. Not Tompkins Square, Washington Square Park, but you were at something at Cooper Union that was about technology and podcasting, or Olga was there.
Well, you know, Horizons has grown, and the last time I went, the first day was at Cooper Union.
It could have been.
Then they went back to Judson Memorial Church, I think, for the last day. But there's a lot of stuff that happens there. So, yeah, who knows what it was.
I went to the first Horizons in, I don't know, 2000, whatever. That was the only one I've been to. It was the very first one. I was really excited that there was a conference about psychedelics with all the luminaries of the day. And that was really one of the first ones I'd ever seen since, I don't know, in that era of like the 2000s. Anyway, well, cool, man. And you moved since then. At the time, you were living in New York, but you're in Vermont now?
That is correct.
So you've been there a few years. A
couple years. Yeah, I'm into my third year here.
How's that going?
Oh, it's going all right. I mean, I've got my little corner of the world staked out, and I keep doing what I do, you know.
You've got a beard. So you're
I do have
right
a beard.
I've shaved my beard. I moved to Southern Utah, and so I kind of made the leap into the great unknown of the American wilds as well.
So somebody who lives in Vermont is a Vermonter. What is somebody who lives in Utah?
Oh, God, I should probably know this. It's probably Utahan or Utahian. A Mormon? Basically a Mormon.
But
I'm Mormon, KMO. I don't know if I told you that, but yeah, I'm officially Mormon too.
You converted?
Yeah, all the way, baby.
Excellent.
Yep. Going to the temple, wearing the special clothes, sealing my family. I'm doing it all. Yeah.
Very nice.
No, but seriously, like, I'm really curious how things have been going up, because I haven't spoken to you since you moved up there. I might have seen a few videos or podcasts and gardening, farming, straw bale things you were getting into. But I mean, how's it been? How's the experience been sort of going? Because I know leaving New York City was a big deal for Olga, and I'm sure that for you it was a big step too. And what's it like?
Well, I don't live with Olga anymore. I live in an apartment here in Bellas Falls. And my life, you know, as so many people at this time, I don't have a single job, which, you know, provides me with my livelihood. I do a variety of things. And I have to spend a lot of time podcasting, which is me sitting here in front of this computer. And I also, until very recently, I was working at my gym, which is across the parking lot from the building where I live. And I also shoot video for a local TV station, and they are located in that same building as the gym, right across this parking lot from where I live. And so I can go many, many days at a time without leaving this little complex.
That must be kind of nice to keep things super local.
It is. It is. You know, a couple weeks back, I went out to start my truck, and it wouldn't start. The battery was dead. And I figured out that the battery was dead because I was never drive for weeks at a time. I wouldn't drive the truck for more than a minute or two at a time. You know, it's usually just when I'm taking video equipment from where I live down to the town hall to shoot meetings. And it's a very short drive. And I would walk if I didn't have all this video equipment. And just those short little trips and never getting out on the highway and driving for any length of time, the battery just runs down.
Yeah, you got to run it for at least 15 minutes, I'd say, every 2 or 3 weeks. To get that battery charged. Maybe that's a good sign. It's a sign of a localized existence when your battery can't charge in your car because if you don't drive far enough.
Yeah, that is a good sign. And it's good to have AAA, which I do.
So when you're out there in Vermont, you've been doing a lot of your podcasting. And I was talking to Lorenzo Haggerty the other day. And your name came up, and we were sort of reminiscing that both of you started your podcast, the C-Realm podcast, started probably around that time when he started, because his is one of the oldest.
He's been doing it longer.
He said 14 years he's been doing his.
Yeah, I started in October of 2006.
That's a long time.
Yeah, it is a long time. But he had been doing his for a little while before that, like more than a year before that. And I largely patterned my podcast after the Psychedelic Salon and after the Dopecast.
I mean, you focused a bit more on interviews than archival talks and things like that. But
True.
As the subject matter, there is definitely some crossover. That's probably how I found you in the first place. Well, I was going to ask you a question about your podcast. And one thing I was always curious about was some of the subject matters that you got into, particularly at the time. Some of them weren't really being spoken about much. And I know it wasn't something that you dug into relatively deeply on a regular basis, but you did talk about psychedelics on your podcast in one form or another. I mean, some of it was based in personal experience, but you get into that with guests when it would come up as maybe an interest of theirs or their own experience. And I'm just curious where that is in your life now and you know, what role that played before? I mean, how is it that that became something that you were interested in and talked about personally?
Well, I got interested in it by doing it basically when I was much younger.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of acid, you know, mostly. And at the time, this is the late 80s, I had no way of knowing what it was I was taking. I mean, it was called acid and it came on blotter paper, but whether it was actually LSD-25 or something else, I would have no way to know.
Right.
But I did a lot of that. And later in life, I got interested in ayahuasca. I've been to Peru 4 times now, searching for the archetypal ayahuasca experience and never really got it. I mean, it's great to go to Peru.
You go to the same place every time?
No, I've been to a lot of different places.
Okay.
But I've had little tiny flashes, little glimpses of, you know, connecting with that other world with ayahuasca, but never the full-on connection.
Oh, that's too bad. But maybe that's what you needed.
It's good to go to the Amazon.
Yeah. But nonetheless, I mean, it's something that you were interested in, that you talked about. I mean, it's not like you just shunned this as part of your subject matter. And I know there was some pushback at sometimes from listeners who thought, like, I'm not interested in that, or I don't want you to talk about that for whatever reason. So what kept you going about it?
Well, I guess ultimately nothing, because I don't talk about it much anymore. But My audience, particularly early on, was a strange mix, because Lorenzo put a link to the C-Realm podcast on the main page of his website. It was there for years. So that's where a lot of my audience came from. They were people, you know, Terrence McKenna fans and people who were explicitly interested in talking about ayahuasca and DMT and that sort of thing. And then the other side of the other part of the audience came from the peak oil world. And a lot of these people they're very curmudgeonly. A lot of them were very anti-drug, you know, to them. There's no point in distinguishing between marijuana, methamphetamine, and heroin. They're all just drugs and they're bad.
Right.
And, you know, people with that mentality who wanted to hear a in an interview with James Howard Kunstler or Dmitry Orlov, they don't want to hear about drugs, you know? So, yeah, I got a lot of, I guess you could call it pushback, or just people asserting that, you know, I think for their own psychological comfort, they were asserting that they were not interested in that part of the topic, you know, the subject matter of the Sea Realm podcast.
Sure.
Well, you've always been someone who's definitely tread your own path and been on the edges. And I definitely can sympathize with not wanting to get too far into the center of society. And some of the subject matters, like the one you just brought up, peak oil, perhaps points to the impetus for that and sort of the motivation for always trying to stay ahead of some kind of curve as a way of protection, but also maybe as a way of just an emotional response to a society that we can see through a bit. And I'm just curious, like, where that started with you, because you've really always, if I can track back what I know about your own life, maybe you could go through that a little bit. But I mean, how did you end up like staying at farms and doing sort of caretaking and woofing? And you really put an active effort into not falling into sort of the normal dreamlike existence, the normal path. You did. I don't think it was by accident. So I'd like to know, like, I mean, maybe we could just take it back a second. Like, I don't even know where you grew up.
I mostly grew up in the suburbs of Kansas City, Missouri.
Oh, wow. That's a place with some tough weather. I've been there a few times.
Yeah.
It's like someone described Kansas City to me once, like that they have like a week of amazing spring and then it just gets hot. And it got real hot there. And then it gets real cold there too.
Yep. This is true.
There are some I know a lot of really cool people when I lived in Portland who moved from there. A lot of people actually from Kansas City became my close friends. And I ended up playing there a few times. But anyway, Kansas City is where you had your beginnings.
Well, and it's not where I had my beginnings, but it's where I spent the longest time.
Formative time.
Yeah. As an adult, I've lived all over. You know, I lived in Seattle for a long time, and I've lived in Japan and Australia. I've worked on fishing boats in Alaska. I tried to create a farm in Arkansas, and Arkansas is where I was born. It's where my mother lives. It's where, you know, she was born and her parents lived. And, you know, now lived in New York City and lived in Tennessee on the farm, you know, that big hippie commune or former commune. And I worked at Amazon, you know, when I lived in Seattle, and I got a nice stock option windfall, which was kind of a curse for me because it basically took me out of, you know, having to make money and sort of create a career for myself during my 30s. Yeah. You know, to take your 30s off from your career and then to have to get back on that treadmill in your 40s is pretty tough.
Yeah. So, wait, this was Amazon, early Amazon, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I had stock options before they went public, so I did pretty well. I made a lot of money with one phone call, basically.
Were you doing like customer support there?
Or I was, yeah.
So you're on the phone and in a chair?
It was mostly email, but yeah, I was sitting in a chair, and there were phone shifts, so I did get to talk to people. And I was, because I'd been there from nearly the very beginning, I was the person that, you know, you didn't get me when you first called with. If you called and the person you talked to couldn't help you, then you got to me.
You were a specialist.
Well, I was the guy who
the angry people would talk to, probably.
Yeah. Basically, I had studied NLP and I had studied what was then called speed seduction. It was the precursor to the pickup artist movement, and I had some psychological tricks up my sleeve. And
how'd that work for you?
Well, it got me on the phone with a bunch of very angry people.
And you got dates with them? Or
No. The point was just to talk them down off the ledge, you know.
So what did your mother and father do?
My father was a Secret Service agent for 20 years.
Shut up.
Yeah, which is why we had to move so often, because to get promoted in the Secret Service, you have to get transferred. So we lived a lot of different places, but Kansas City was the place we lived the longest. And it's the place where we were living when my parents got divorced. So I didn't have to move, you know, again as part of his career after that.
Was he doing counterfeit stuff or stuff with presidential advancing or
both?
Security, both?
Yep.
A little bit of everything?
As far as I understand it, you know, it may have changed in recent decades, but in his day, everybody did everything.
Sure. What president was that, or what eras was he in?
Well, there was a picture on his wall when of him as a young man trotting next to Richard Nixon's vehicle, you know, with Nixon popping out the top. But he spent time, he was assigned to guard Gerald Ford's son for a time, and he spent time on the campaign trail in 1980 with George H.W. Bush. Mm-hmm. And in fact, my father was so enamored with the George Bush Sr. that in the 1980 election, when Reagan won, my father wrote in George H.W. Bush as you know, his choice for president.
Wow. I mean, I guess Secret Service agents are people too. They have political opinions and leanings, but they...
Yeah. And when I was young, he was assigned to guard Bess Truman, Harry Truman's widow. She lived in Independence, Missouri. So that's, we first moved to Kansas City so he could do that job. And then when she died, he got transferred to the Kansas City field office. So we didn't have to move. You know, he got to move in his career and we didn't have to move houses. And then after that, my parents got divorced. So I wasn't following him around anymore. Yeah, my mother, she was a little bit older than my father, and she was a very good student. She had her master's degree, and she was working on a PhD in chemistry when she got pregnant. And he was an undergrad still, because he had flunked out and went and joined the Air Force, and then came back and was, you know, completing his undergraduate degree. And this is 1968, so, you know, I guess it was 67 when she got pregnant. At the time, the woman's career would never have come first. So she dropped out and became a housewife, and he finished his degree and then got his job with the Secret Service. And, you know, she was a housewife for most of her life.
She never got to finish her PhD?
No, but when I was growing up, she studied a variety of different things, and she got a collection of additional degrees, but never the PhD in chemistry.
Mm. Was there any bitterness from her on that, or resentment?
Not that she voiced to me.
Yeah. Yeah. So did you grow up in suburbia in
pretty much
Kansas City? Okay.
Yep. I basically came into consciousness in Spokane, Washington. That's where my parents were living when I was old enough to start forming permanent memories. And then we moved to Pleasant Hill, California, which is a suburb of San Francisco, and then to Kansas City. So those are the places where I was a kid, and each one of those was a suburban experience.
Well, when did you come into your second consciousness, your second attention, shall we say? You know, for me, that was, I'd say, in my late 20s. There was like a lot of experiences that just all sort of seemed to come at the same time at the right way, where part of that was psychedelics, and it was part of that was just where I was and friendships and things happening in the world at that time, like Reality Sandwich and becoming friends with those guys and Evolver and all that sort of stuff happening. But can you think of a time and place where you felt like you started to wake up, or you sort of felt you always had that viewpoint of looking from the outside in?
Well, I think for the what you're talking about, it would have been in the late 80s, and it would have been when I first started doing LSD, and I was also interested in various what I would now consider to be, you know, new age meditation type paths, creative visualization, that sort of thing. Very new agey stuff. I mean, this is
late 80s.
Yeah, it was the late 80s. So, you know, I would go to the bookstore at the mall, and there was a new age section. That's what it was called. And that's where I would go and see what was on the shelf. And there was some good stuff on the shelf there next to some not so good stuff. So I got into the work of Richard Bach. You know, he wrote Jonathan Livingston Seagull and Illusions, The Adventures of a Reluctant Messiah. So his work was pretty meaningful to me. And also there's a pretty strong sort of hippie psychedelic bent to Robert Heinlein's later science fiction novels. You know, like, the biggie is Stranger in a Strange Land.
Cool. You know,
so there was a lot to be garnered there for somebody who was interested in that stuff. He was also, you know, he was a military man, and he wrote very military sort of science fiction early on, you know, stuff like Starship Troopers. So it was strange that he got such a whopping dose of like open, you know, sexual freedom. And he doesn't talk about drugs at all, as far as I recall, but there's a lot of very spiritual, mystical sort of stuff that was definitely in the air in that period, which shows up in his books. And, you know, maybe he did did indulge and just didn't talk about it. He, Robert Heinlein, actually supported Philip K. Dick for a time. You know, Philip K. Dick, his whole life as a career was never making enough money for that to be his full-time job.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, well, that's what contributed to his psychosis and his health problems, is that he would work in a record store all day and then come home at night and take amphetamine so he could stay up all night and write his science fiction novels. And, you know, one, just the lack of sleep will take it out of you.
Oh,
have cumulative effects. And also, you know, speed. Not good. So, but it, there were times when Philip K. Dick, you know, he couldn't pay the light bills and such. And Robert Heinlein would you know, help him out with some money.
Damn. So books was one of the big things, more than community, or obviously the internet wasn't really active at all.
I had 80s. no experience of the internet in the 1980s.
And well, but you have such an experience with it now. So, I mean, at some point, was a podcast of things that sort of did it for you, that sort of lit the fuse? Or was there something, was it about community for you, or a certain place took it to where it sort of went and where it is today for you?
My most significant early experience online was with multiplayer online games in a text-based environment. Like Lambda Moo was the first one I did. You know, Moo is, what is it? Multi-user object-oriented. And there was also Mushes, which were multi-user simulated habitats. And
these
Muds,
text-based?
Yeah, text-based. But there was, you know, it's like Second Life or World of Warcraft or something where there's a lot of people in a shared environment, but you got a little piece of it and you could describe it. You know, you'd walk into a new room and you'd see a text description of what was there. And that was some really compelling stuff. And early IRC, Internet Relay Chat, that was some of my, you know, really formative experiences online. And then through the late 90s and the first part of the, you know, first decade of the 21st century, I was really into LiveJournal, which, you know, to this day, for me, remains a completely superior experience to, say, Facebook.
Mm.
And I was listening to your conversation just earlier today, the one that you recorded with Lorenzo.
Mm-hmm.
And he was talking about how he's completely off Facebook. And I'm one of those people who doesn't like Facebook. I don't like the effect that it has on society. I don't like the effect that it has on me personally. But at the same time, you know, there is a community there devoted to the Sea Realm podcast. And I just can't bring myself to cut ties with it.
Well, I'm in a similar way. I haven't been actively on social media for several months, maybe six, maybe more. And I have mostly Rachel in my management team, who I'll send her content and things to post, but I'm not the one actually interfacing with it so much, because I was also feeling sort of a net negative with it. And I'm also very leery about just what's going on with a lot of social media and what it's doing, and it's sort of that same thinking, whether it is a net positive. And I feel very conflicted about this. And if I wasn't active with East Forest, I don't think I would probably be on it at all. And the only reason I am is because you're really expected to and needed to as a musician. Like a lot of bookings and certain things that I do, they require that you give them these links. There's not even an option to not include that. Like, it's a required field.
Right.
So like, I couldn't complete the, you know, inquiry without that. And so I'm sort of forced to play this game, but I'm doing it reluctantly. And it's just Facebook in particular. I don't think we're very conscious about what this medium is and what it's doing to us psychologically. Have you ever gotten into any of these articles or interviews with people who've worked there, who are designers, and they talk about the psychological design of it? And I mean, thousands of the most talented people designing how long the delay is on your notifications number, for instance, and how that works the dopamine of your brain. I mean, everything is about maximizing the time you spend on the platform. And that sort of the longer that is, the more successful they are, the better they're doing at their job, the more they get promoted and so forth. And so it becomes like your attention is your currency. And that's something in this world these days, with information coming at us from all these different directions, you know, your attention being your currency is at a point that I don't think many of us recognize or realize how valuable that really is.
Or the downstream effects of the attention economy. Because, you know, I mentioned LiveJournal, which was an early social networking sort of experience. But in LiveJournal, you know, if you go to your feed and you just look at the other things that your friends have posted, you just see everything that every single person that you are a friend with has posted in the order in which they posted them. There is no curation. There is no algorithm.
Isn't that how Facebook used to be? If I remember correctly, a long time ago, it used to be like that.
Yeah, but when you introduce the, you know, the algorithm which determines what it is you see, and the motivation for that algorithm is to keep you engaged.
Yeah.
And the motivation to keep you engaged is to show you advertising for which they're paying. Then you get into a situation where they want you to stay engaged with the site, but they don't want you to stay on any one page very long because they want to continually show you a new set of ads for which they will get paid, which encourages very sort of short-term, sloppy thinking. It encourages, you know, what's called the hot take, which is not thinking very clearly about something, but just giving your immediate, you know, emotional response. And what I really don't like about what this generates, particularly in myself, is just the ideological extremes that people go to in these environments. When you are, when the algorithm is deciding what it is it's going to show you, it's either going to show you things that you already agree with and you're just going to hit like, or it's going to show you things that it knows is going to make you mad. And that anger and that indignation of somebody, you know, discounting a belief system that you hold dear, it provokes a very personal and very defensive and aggressive response. And, you know, to live in that mindset all day and, you know, particularly when you have it on your phone and to go back to it time and time again, to have that stoked throughout the course of the day, every day, for weeks, months, years on end.
Yeah, it's an addiction response, and it's also codifying these different neural networks in your own brain, like you're saying. I mean, the most amazing thing about this, they're talking about the algorithm, which is a form of artificial intelligence that they're developing. And so who is the they that's actually deciding what you see? This is where it gets really strange. It's like, it's a program that is using forms of artificial intelligence to figure out what you want. But in doing so, it's actually you, through your behavior on Facebook, creating a self-fulfilling prophecy of larger, of deeper and deeper chasms of disparity of like the things you like and the things you don't like. And I do believe it does create this sense of dichotomy in like, that gets deeper and deeper, that's probably not serving you. Because it's, for instance, there was a study, I believe I heard about, that the researchers created some headlines that were really tasty and clickable and shareable. But if you clicked on the article, it was just gobbledygook. There's nothing there. Right. And 70% of people or something would share it because they're not reading the article. And it shows the clickbait of headlines and the way we get news from headlines. It's probably sort of what Trump is talking about when he says something like fake news in a way. You know, in his own ignorance, he's actually tapping into a truth in a way about that it all is sort of this sea of just sort of headlined, you know, you can kind of make a story go either direction you want it to go based on how you just make a, not that I'm a Trump supporter, but, you know, he's like the ultimate court jester, like a mirror of a symptom in a way of like what's happening. And that's why it's so profane and so ridiculous, because that's where we're at. He's almost created by social media. He's like an avatar of our own dream that we've created from our activities of this, like he's an AI dream in a way.
A CROM listener described him as the first troll president. You know, troll in the internet
100%. Do you ever get trolled as like part of, I'm getting trolled like on social media recently. Like I said, I'm not on it. And I had to just tap in yesterday to someone's like, you should see this thing someone posted. And I was like, all right, I had to find my password. I log in and I get on there. And the first thing I see is like a trolley comment. And it's just immediately is like, I got to get out of here. It's just like, I don't know, but it's not something I'm used to being, you know, trolled.
Yeah. I don't get that much. I make some YouTube videos from time to time, and comments on YouTube are the worst.
It's always comments. Worst. Yeah, it's like the comments sections where people just like throw things out because I don't know why. I have no idea why, what good comes out of that for them.
Something. Yeah. No, I think it's easy to get addicted to indignation, you know, particularly righteous indignation, where you think that you have the morally superior framework and viewpoint, and the people that don't are not only wrong, but they're propagating evil. You know, and every time you go and you just assault them online, you know, with your typing fingers, you're striking a blow for righteousness, which is a very powerful neurological reward, that state where you believe that you are
righteous. Yes, it creates that us versus them, and it makes it deeper and deeper every time, even in those small moments. That is problematic.
That's a word I never use, by the way.
So what do you think the solution is for the average person? I mean, do you recommend that they bring more consciousness or pull out of social media a little more? Or?
Well, I just turned 50, so I'm probably not in a space to be giving advice about how to use the internet to 20-year-olds, you know? For me, taking the Facebook app off my phone did a lot of good.
Yeah.
So that it wasn't always there with me. You know, I'd have to go to my laptop to actually interface with Facebook. But I spent pretty much all day at my laptop.
Right.
You know, the phone for me is a secondary sort of thing. It's just that if I'm away from my living environment where I do most of my work and I'm out into the world, there is no temptation to pick up my phone and reconnect with the social media conversation. It's, you know, it would be a pain to do so.
The people design their lives like that. I mean, there's a return now. I just saw the flip phone. They're redesigning the flip phone. So it's sort of a semi-smartphone. Mm-hmm. But I'm sure that's a reaction against the people who are a little bit leery of how deep they are with their phones.
Yeah, the smartphone is a powerful thing. It's crazy how powerful they are in terms of just the raw horsepower under the hood.
Yeah. You
know, for me, my first computer was an Apple II Plus, and it had 64K of active, you know, random access memory.
Yeah.
Which, you know, I don't think you could design a phone that could make a phone call that had the, you know, the horsepower that my first computer did. But, you know, we don't get – like we've had multiple iterations of Moore's Law of price, you know, computing power for the price doubling every 18 to 24 months. In just, you know, in the time that I've done the podcast, it has doubled repeatedly. And yet the utility of the functionality – has not doubled.
You know, say more about that.
Well, think about word processing. You know, you got Microsoft Word or whatever people use. I type everything just in a Gmail window. You know, I just open a new email message and I start typing. It doesn't matter, you know, what I'm typing for, because if it crashes, Gmail or Google has backed up that document every few seconds.
Right.
And also, you know, if I were to open a special program to start typing, then I'm going to get this sort of, you know, writer's block response of, oh, you know, it's like writing in a hardbound, leather-bound journal. It's like, oh, this is a very nice journal. I have to be very precise and, you know, I have to put a lot into this. Has to be worth reading. And there's nothing like that with a, you know, just a Gmail, you know, mail composition window. But we're getting off topic. Word processing is amazing. It is so much better than a typewriter.
Well, that's for sure. That's one of the first things that we got with computing, you know, in early DOS. It was like the ability to word process, cut and paste.
But my Apple II Plus could do everything that I need a word processor to do now, pretty much. I mean, I couldn't import graphics that looked like anything that anybody would want to look at. But in terms of composing text and making changes and sharing that information with people, everything that I needed was right there. And the new, you know, the latest version of whatever, you know, word processing is standard has got all manner of stuff in it that I will never, ever use.
Sure.
You know, but it's there. But in terms of, you know, my need to compose text and share it with people, the fact that the new programs are much, much more powerful, I mean, many times more powerful, and the underlying hardware is many times more powerful, it doesn't bring me a commensurate level of benefit in terms of, you know, what this stuff can do for me or what I can do using it. I'm going to go pick up this cat and hold her on my lap, and she'll probably stop meowing when I do that.
Okay.
I don't know if you can hear her, but
that's okay. I can't.
Okay. Well, if you can't, then let's not worry about it.
I'm just going to shut this door.
Okay. Come here, you.
I haven't.
Come here. I'm annoying. Bed. You have been fed. All right.
Yeah, I actually didn't hear it on the headphones, but yeah, it's
with, there she is.
There she is. With Moore's Law, one thing that is interesting to me is that I don't feel like our lives have gotten, how should I say, easier. You know, with technological advances, we haven't hit that Jetsons phase where now, oh, we have more time, we have more leisure. If anything, we seem to have less time. And no one seems to really be picking up, well, I shouldn't say no one, but overall, we seem to be happy to go along with the ride of more information, you know, more input, even though we see the decreasing benefits of that. Yet it's interesting that we keep wanting to get more and faster and better. And I've heard arguments that Moore's Law is slowing down, or they argue that it will not be an exponential curve in the future because of all these different technical reasons. But nonetheless, it seems to be pointing towards some sort of concrescence or singularity, as some people put it. It's not something I buy into. I'm not a singularitarian in thinking that machines will ever achieve consciousness. I think that's sort of an absurd idea. I think they could mimic it in a way that we might not be able to tell the difference. But I'm not sure where it's all going, other than I can tell that it's heading towards a sort of pinpoint of something that feels exponential. But where do you think it's headed?
Well, you mentioned
the million-dollar question.
Your conversation with Lorenzo, you talked about, you know, the pre-2012 years.
Oh, my favorite years.
Yeah.
Those were amazing.
Because, you know, we in the psychedelic community and the, you know, devotees of Terence McKenna, we were looking forward to December 21st, 2012 as, you know, a singular date when everything was going to change.
Yep.
And it didn't. You know, but right. I was looking forward to it for years. And then as the day was approaching, I, you know, had lost any confidence that there would be anything happening on that day. And then after that day, you know, it was really hard to stave off a cynicism that was sinking in. And, you know, at the same time, I was listening to these folks who were talking about, you know, how our society runs on fossil fuel energy. And without it, we're not going to be able to sustain the levels of technological and social complexity that we all take for granted. And, you know, it's going to go away in this dramatic crash, which hasn't happened yet. And I don't think is going to happen.
Yeah. Peak oil is interesting because, like, I've had times where I've been a campfire with someone who's worked for Exxon all their lives and just retired. And you talk to them, they're like, oh, I mean, there's plenty of oil for decades to come. We can go deeper and bigger. And like, as far as running out of oil, it's like, yes, at one point we will. I'm not smart enough to understand, you know, OPEC and oil markets and prices of oil. And that's like a bigger deal than if we run out. But I would say that it seems to be like the bigger of things is like whether the effects of all of our use of fossil fuels catches up with us before we run out of the fossil fuels, and whether or not the economy itself is almost, I don't know if there's such a thing as peak economy, but commodifying things until we run out of things to commodify. And as we saw in 2008, you know, our economy is, as on a global level, is quite fragile. And nothing has really changed since that crash on the legislative end. Matter of fact, I think they just rolled back some of the Dodd-Frank stuff they put in, which wasn't even enough. So, I mean, we're really doing the same things we were doing before. And it's a house of cards financially. And that would really screw up the world probably faster than us running out of oil.
Well, the idea of peak oil was never that we would run out. It's just that the more energy you have to put into the process of extracting energy, the less net energy you're getting out, which means it's worth less. You know, if you spend a dollar to get $100 worth of oil out of the ground, that's a good return. If you spend $1.50 to get 75 cents worth out of the ground, that's not doable.
So this is sort of like the tar sands in Canada and how they were banking most of their economy on that. And then oil prices dropped, I believe. And then it didn't really work so well. And
well, the tar sands, and that's a good example, the tar sands. That whole operation wouldn't work if the Canadians didn't have this huge resource of natural gas. You know, that's the energy. The natural gas is the energy that they are using to extract and refine this really low-grade oil that is in the tar sands.
Such madness.
Yeah. Well, it's total madness because natural gas or methane is this beautifully pure fuel. I mean, it doesn't have to be refined. You know, you don't have to have all this infrastructure to crack it down into its various pieces. And, you know, it's just usable. It just it contains a lot of energy as is, whereas oil is not like that. Oil requires significant refining, and you don't get a single product out of it. You know, you get kerosene and gasoline and bunker fuel, which is what ships use, and jet fuel. And, you know, if you don't, this is a point that Dmitry Orlov makes. Your job really is to drive a car and use gasoline, because gasoline it's the largest portion of, you know, what we get from the oil refining process, but it's not really the thing that we need the most. What we need the most really is jet fuel.
It's not Vaseline? No.
Vaseline is a brand name for petroleum jelly. No, what we need to be able to fly planes and to move ships.
Right.
We could totally get along without individual automobiles.
And move freight trains to move coal, which is probably a lot of diesel.
But economically, the whole gasoline, the whole oil refining process doesn't work unless you have somebody on hand to buy the gasoline.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. So economically, your job is to drive and burn gas. That is your role in this society.
Wow, that's depressing. How do you feel about the electric car movement and that actually being something that changes the needle, or is it just going to be decades and decades before it's a real significant shift?
It depends on battery technology. You know, right now, an electric vehicle, even a super fine $100,000 Tesla, would be of no use to me because I couldn't drive to Maryland and back in a day, which I would need to sometimes if I'm going to go see my kids or, you know, go pick one of them up.
Right.
I need to be able to stop and refuel along the way.
Yeah, if we got to 500 miles, that'd pretty much be a game changer, or even 350 or something, probably 500.
Well, I would need more than 500, you know, for the drive I need to do. And I can't afford to stop and spend 2-3 hours, you know, recharging a battery.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know. I'm more interested not just in how the cars are powered, but I'm interested in the idea that individual people don't have to own vehicles. They can just, you know, call a ride when they need it, and it's affordable. I can't take taxis. You know, I can't. I'm not at that economic strata where I can routinely get in a cab and pay $5, you know, for a 5-minute ride, or you know, $20 or whatever. And it doesn't cost me that much to have a 20-year-old vehicle that I just, you know, keep insured to the minimum required by law and drive as little as possible. But it's always there when I need it. So if we have a fleet of autonomous vehicles, and I don't care if they're electric powered or internal combustion, really, that's the least significant part of it. But if they don't have – like if you get in your car and you drive to work and you park, well – your car is sitting inert most of the time, and it's taking up space all day in that parking space, which deforms the whole place where you have gone to work. You know, there has to be this huge lagoon of pavement where people's inert cars just sit there doing nothing all day so that they can be there for the people when they come out and they need to go home. There's no reason for that. So, you know, if you can have a fleet of autonomous vehicles, which are pretty much always in motion and they're optimized by AI and lots of data, you know, to be where they need to be, to predict the demand for traffic and for transportation at particular times in particular places, then, you know, you don't have to have all of this space where all of these cars are just sitting around doing nothing. And you don't have to have, you know, all of the embedded energy that goes into a vehicle for every single person, just so that vehicle can sit there and do nothing most of the time.
Yeah. Yeah, but then you got to deal with people wasteful. Like getting drunk in your back seat and
yeah, so it goes.
No, I'm with you, man. If I could have a self-driving car that could drive me overnight and I could just sleep while I'd travel at night all the time. I wouldn't waste my time spending all day driving, especially for a touring musician. It's like having a bus driver, being on a tour bus, but it's, you know, more affordable. Well, one thing I wanted to ask you about is in some of these different transitions you've made in life and, you know, working your best to kind of live consciously, so you're not, you know, the way that you're talking about your use of social media or the way you want to keep things kind of localized. Perhaps some of that is a situational, but at the end of the day, it's a choice. I would imagine like some fears come up on a day-to-day level, and and I'm curious what does come up for you when you're, you know, trying to live the life that you feel like you want to live. I mean, ultimately you're doing it because you think that's the best way for you to do things. You know, that's the way to achieve some kind of happiness for you, at least, or a sense of meaning. And in doing that, you're probably going to rub up against some fears that do come up. I mean, what has come up over the years?
Well, my anxieties are mostly for the future that my kids are going to inhabit.
Mm-hmm.
My oldest is 17. He's spends all day, every day online, you know, when he's not at school. And he cannot walk up to a person working at a cash register in a convenience store or a fast food restaurant and order something and give them money. I mean, he cannot approach somebody in real life like that.
Is that his personality? Or I think it's, you're saying it's connected to a life, maybe not having a skill set that you're used to doing that because you're online.
It's both. It's certainly his personality, because his younger brother can totally do that.
Sure.
You know, and his younger brother lives in that same environment. But you know, he thinks that he's going to be on Easy Street because he's good at math and he's, you know, good with computers and stuff. And those sorts of jobs that are right now are the high paying jobs. That's the easiest stuff to automate.
Right. You
know, most new jobs in the 21st century are in the same categories of jobs that people were working in the 20th century. They're service jobs, they're construction jobs, you know, they're driving. They're dealing with people. And the difference is that they're not highly paid like they used to be. You know, now somebody might be working 2, 3, 4 jobs, struggling to get by, where in the past they could have worked one of those jobs and bought a house and put their kids through college. You know, it's the economy that has changed. And yeah, right now, if you can write code, you can probably make a decent living. But I don't think that's going to last. I don't think that's going to hold.
Why? You think the code will be written by AI in a larger percentage?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm. That's interesting. I would have, so if I had kids, which I don't, I would just tell them to learn how to code. But
yeah, I mean, that's the common wisdom right now. And I'm certainly not saying he shouldn't. You know, that is a superpower of sorts, and it is a good thing to have. And like learning a foreign language, it is best done young, you know, but it's not a magic bullet. And even the people who are really good at coding and they move to San Francisco and they try to get a job, you know, at Google or Facebook or Twitter or wherever, they burn out really quickly. You know,
yeah.
They spend long periods of time coding,
yeah.
You know, going without sleep, just depending on massive doses of caffeine and other drugs. I mean, other modafinil and various drugs like that, you know, that let you go,
yep,
long periods without sleep. That stuff catches up with you, and they are wrecking their adrenal systems in the process.
Mm.
And so, you know, some of them make a lot of money, but it's, you know, they spend a lot of money in that environment. It's not like they're making a huge nest egg that they're then going to take back to wherever they came from and start a business or something. I mean, more likely they're going to be crawling back to their parents, you know, in their late 20s, just totally burnt out and sort of traumatized and basically broke.
Yeah.
So,
well, let's hope not.
it happens though. I mean, that's
yeah,
a common occurrence
does.
Now. It is a common life path for people in that industry now. So to say, let's hope it doesn't work out that way is meaningless. You know,
well,
it's like saying, let's hope we
to
don't
you.
Become dependent on fossil fuels. That,
right,
that ship has
right.
sailed.
So, I mean, what are the things you do, even just day to day? Do you have any practices that or habits, I should even say, that sort of things that help you kind of keep your own ship of life sailing straight?
Well, this year I have decided that I will not be drinking any alcohol or smoking any marijuana this year.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a daily meditation practice, which meditation's a weird thing because, you know, for me anyway, I can't tell that it's benefiting me until I fall off the train and stop practicing. And then I get agitated.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh,
and
for sure. That's the way
I can
tell
that I've lost something.
Yep.
But you know, I'm on this path where I have a set number of pieces of media that I have to create every week. You know, I do a comic strip as well. I'm the illustrator on a comic strip. And I spend a lot of time, you know, just in front of this computer with a drawing tablet, just creating art. And as a kid, I would have thought, you know, if you had told me, okay, you're going to make your living in the future by creating media, and part of that's going to be comic strips, and some of it's going to be video, and some of it's going to be just you talking into a microphone, I would have thought, wow, that sounds great. You know, I'm going to be a working artist. Awesome.
Yeah.
But to be doing that, but in an economically precarious position, whereby, you know, I have to do that stuff. That's the stuff that keeps the lights on. That's the stuff that, you know, allows me to buy stuff at the grocery store. And if I were to lose my way, or if I were to lose my motivation, or if I, you know, would some injury or illness were to befall me, and I couldn't do that, I would be in deep shit really quickly. You know, yeah. I submitted an invoice on the 12th of April for some comic strip work that I had done. And it was slow in getting here. It got here yesterday, but yesterday morning when it hadn't arrived, I got in touch with the person who pays me to do that and said, hey, I sent you this invoice on the 12th. You know if this has been processed? Because I have to write a rent check this coming Tuesday. And if those funds from that one check hadn't hit my bank account by the time I had to write the check, then, you know, I wouldn't be able to pay my rent.
That's rough. Yeah, that is stressful.
So it's not a situation that I want to continue, but at the same time, the things that, I mean, what are the alternatives? You know, I could move away from here because I can't stop all of that stuff that I do to make money and go get a job living here in Vermont, because there just aren't jobs. There's nothing I could do here that would replace the income that I would lose if I stopped that process. I'd have to move back to a city. And, you know, to do that, I'd need an upfront investment in order to get an apartment and, you know, to establish myself in the city. And then I know, I mean, I have tried to sell out that artistic vision repeatedly over the course of my life. I thought, okay, I'm putting all that stuff behind me. I'm just going to get a regular real job, and I'm going to do it diligently, and I'm going to make money, and I'm going to support myself and meet my obligations, you know, like a responsible adult. And it never, never works out. You know, I've not worked any straight job for more than 2 years my entire life. Wow. You know, and I'm 50. So I've had a lot of jobs.
Part of that's just because it just doesn't jive with you. I mean, so when you say you don't want to compromise that artistic vision, what is that vision?
You know, I think it's just a commitment to using the skills that I've spent so long honing to create stuff that is useful for people. You know, the last straight job I had, it was a full-time thing that gave me benefits and stuff, which I'm glad I worked it because I needed some medical attention at the time and it came with medical benefits. But I was working, you know, at Comcast doing tech support / customer service. And I worked there for a little less than 2 years. And when I first started it, man, I was just diligent and chipper and really into it. And by the end, I was just angry and bitter.
That's a rough one. I mean, I can imagine the people talking to you were... That must have been really hard.
The customers aren't the problem. It's the management. It's the structure of the environment that's the problem with that job. And, you know, that's a job where you are monitored moment by moment, second by second. What you're doing is being recorded and evaluated. And then, you know, you get these reports back to you. Exactly. And it would destroy me that I would have to use, you know, whatever equipment I could afford to do my podcast, which was on material that was important to me. I thought the content was valuable. And then millions and millions of dollars worth of equipment was devoted to me talking to customers about this utterly trivial nonsense. You know, every syllable recorded, every keystroke monitored and recorded, you know, and in great fidelity, you know, lots just wonderful resources and technical infrastructure devoted to something which didn't bring happiness to anybody. Edify anybody.
A lady who called in tech support because her CD-ROM drive, or what she thought was a cup holder, was broken.
I had people actually call in to Comcast because the Wi-Fi network that they usually used wasn't there, and I would ask them, you know, for some piece of identifying information that would allow me to call up their account. And they didn't have an account. They weren't even Comcast customers. They had been piggybacking off of somebody else's Wi-Fi.
They're pissed off that it's gone.
When it's gone, they called Comcast.
So it sounds like for you, I mean, there's, you recognize the costs that come with holding on to that vision that you have for your own sense of life and work. And you feel like you need to do that because the alternative just is just not, it's untenable. It's just not possible.
Really. I just know it's not going to work.
Right.
I mean, I've tried it so many times, and to try it again now would totally have to uproot myself.
So is there a peace within you about accepting that fate of yourself that you recognize as sort of the laws of the game of your incarnation as it is now?
Well, until somebody asks me about it, I don't think about it much.
I'm sorry.
No, it's good. I mean, it's probably therapeutic.
I mean, you're someone that because of the Sea Realm podcast, when listening to that for all those years, you know, you get to know someone, you know, so I feel like I know you a little better than you probably know me. And there was a way of you holding on to a vision there and sharing ideas with people that I appreciated because they were ideas outside the box. They were ideas that didn't get much of a voice. And I really believe that there is a lot of value in just being a venue for that and holding the light for these different thoughts that they need space to, it's sort of like creating a new story. We need space for that.
When I first got into podcasting, it was so exciting because there were people producing what sounded to me like, you know, professionally produced material, audio programs on psychedelics, you know, on how much they love marijuana, you know, or on really strange topics. Like the Viking Youth Power Hour was one of the early podcasts I listened to that inspired me to get into it. You know, they were talking to Eric Davis and they were talking about Philip K. Dick and Robert Anton Wilson and, you know, stuff that was important to me that I had never heard discussed on the radio. And, you know, podcasts sound a lot like the radio. So I was really excited about that. But now, you know, 13 years later, podcasts are everywhere.
Yep.
You know, for most of the time I was doing the Sea Realm podcast, when I would tell somebody what I did, I would have to explain to them what a podcast was.
Right.
And that's not the case anymore. People know what podcasts are, but there are so many of them that it's really hard to get people to listen to yours.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I have fewer listeners now than I did in, say, 2008.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
There just weren't that many options back then.
Well, maybe it's better not to play the game of trying to be on top and just trying to add value to the world as you say you're doing in your own way. That's more important to you.
But the point that I was working around to is that, you know, the topics that I was giving air to 10 years ago, there weren't other venues doing that. But now there are so many podcasts and so many people know how to access that information that everything I have been talking about in the past and continue to talk about now, other people are talking about it. It's not like I'm, you know, the one of the few sources for information on these topics anymore.
Right.
Which leaves me wondering, well, what's my role here? What am I supposed to be doing now?
I don't know. Just stay unique to what you are interested in. I feel like if you follow the path of like really what turns you on, it'll probably connect with other people too. You know, as opposed to trying to figure out what needs to be said or what other people want to hear. And I feel like you've done that. And I really think there's value in finding out what fires other people up individually.
Well, good. It's encouraging to hear.
So what are your links right now? What do you have out there that people can connect to?
Well, I mentioned I'm doing a comic strip, and you can find that by going to a website called CFPUP. It's Center for Progressive Urban Politics. So CFPUP.org. And the comic is called Terra Inferma. I didn't come up with the name. I'm not really thrilled with it, but that's the name of it. And there's a tab that you can find on that website. So you can see comic strips that I have drawn and I have had some hand in creating, but we also have a writer. But the writer doesn't really share my interest in a lot of stuff. So it's a very interesting sort of tension that behind the scenes that goes into the creation of this thing.
Cool.
Yeah.
Anything else you want to share?
I don't know how to describe it easily, but I have a YouTube site, you know, a YouTube channel. And my main, you know, podcast page has been there for well over – actually, the site, the Sea Realm website, it's C-R-E-A-L-M, Sea Realm. I had had that site, I think, since 94 or 95. I guess it's 95. And, you know, I had had that site for over a decade when I started the podcast.
So, great.
Yeah. Yeah. So there was never any question as to what my podcast would be called.
C-Realm. C-Realm.
Yeah.
Well, cool, man. It was really nice catching up with you. And I really appreciate like getting into your world and into your brain for a little while.
Well, thanks for the invitation.
Yeah. All right. Thanks. Thanks, KMO.
Well, thank you so much, KMO, for joining the podcast and sharing a bit of your time. It's always wonderful to catch up. This music that you're hearing in the background is called Cosmic Washout, and it's from an album called Elements that currently is only available on my Bandcamp site. So if you go to eastforest.org and click on the music tab, it'll take you to that page and you'll see the Elements where you can download it, but it's not distributed through Spotify or anything like that currently. And it came out a few years ago. It's something I did for Tony G. It's like basically the music I wrote for his live, sort of a DVD series we did with Udaya.com. And I performed the music live, and then I distilled it down to a record afterwards, and that's what that is. If you like that, check it out. Tell your friends. Thank you for writing this podcast because it really helps, and please do say hi. info@eastforest.org. Send us a note. Send us your questions. We'll read the relevant ones on the air. And other than that, just keep walking your walk. Don't take any shit. But if you do, do it with grace. Thank you.